Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
What's all this about being caribou? You're about to find out more as Karsten and Leanne have to decide if it's the right time to leave, if they should or even can make the commitment to take that first step into the unknown. The journey continues when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wildside News. We continue our story of adventure and spirit and mystery and dreams with Karsten Hoyer, who is the author of Being Caribou, which is published by Mountaineers Books. And he's taken us to the point where he's about ready to take literally that first committed step to this extraordinary unknown adventure. Karsten, welcome back.
Thanks, Sid.
This is when I was reading your book, and by the way, it's a terrific book. It literally takes the reader along with you. I feel like it's like I know both you and Leanne as friends, having read the book. And the thing that occurred to me, I'm a dreamer and a bit of a romantic, and I like to take on challenges and this and that. And I do that, and then every once in a while, you hit a point where, okay, but now it's the moment where you have to literally, everything's in place now, and now you have to take that first step.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious what was going through your mind, literally, at that moment.
Well, I think we were overwhelmed, to be perfectly honest. And I think the biggest thing that overwhelmed us at that point was just this lack of having any sort of a goal other than to follow wild animals. I mean, what helps us, I think, always to get through tough spots or to move forward as humans is to visualize where it is we're headed, to be fixated, if you will, on some sort of a goal. I mean, that's how we're brought up, and that's how we're kind of taught right from grade school on how to lead our lives. And I think, you know, it's a convenient way, and it's a very productive way to some extent. But I think it's also a way that starts to close down other possibilities. We travel through a lot of life, I think, with blinders on, just so focused on where it is we want to get. And when I say where, I mean, you know, whether it's in terms of some sort of physical situation that we want to be in, or some sort of financial situation, or some sort of emotional situation. I think in direct contrast, what we had to learn to do on this trip, and this is sort of the most painful part of starting, was to let go of all of that, to let go of being able to visualize where it is you're headed, because we didn't know. And we really had to give up all our control over our future to these caribou that we couldn't even see at that time. You know, we'd glimpsed them the day before with Randall on the river, and now we were just following their trail. And not know it, really even knowing if we'd ever see them again, if this whole sort of far-fetched scheme of trying to be caribou, and, you know, these caribou can move 20 to 50 miles a day, is what some of the scientific studies have shown. And here are these two humans with not much Arctic experience sort of trying to follow with them and hoping that once they do catch up to them, the caribou somehow will accept them, accept us, and we would sort of spend this euphoric time of traveling and maybe becoming part of the herd. So those are all ideas, and all of those were doubts. And certainly, you know, those doubts have been articulated. They weren't only our own doubts. They've been doubts articulated by our parents, by other biologists, certainly by a lot of the Gwich'in people in Old Crow and other communities, and also, you know, some of the people that I've worked with, some very well-seasoned travelers, the park wardens, park rangers in a national park, where this whole idea had been hatched a little bit farther to the north. So I think that more than anything describes our state of mind was full of doubt, and really the only step we could do was to just sort of step forward, and much like traveling at night with headlights, is just sort of see where the next corner and where that next gap through the trees and where that those next few hoofprints before us led.
Did you and Leanne have a means to communicate that moment when you decided it was time to commit? It's really a moment. You either, you know, you had the right to turn back and say, you know, maybe we really shouldn't do this.
Yeah, I think we had, by that point, we had put in so much effort and planning and preparation. You know, it would have been terrible to kind of give in at that point. I think we really, Leanne and I are both of the temperament and ilk. I think that once you decide to do a journey, and that moment of commitment had come many months earlier, if not a year earlier for us, and it really was time to sort of see if the actual journey could be what we had visualized or whether it would be something else. And we had to at least try. We had to at least set off and start to understand that. And you know, I guess some of my doubts I had expressed the night before with Randall and even the day before when we first met him in the village of Old Crow. And he kept saying, well, when you get to the calving grounds, and when you follow the caribou off the calving grounds, this and this might happen, or you might see this. And I kept correcting him, saying, no, Randall, if we get to the calving grounds, if we can follow the caribou. And he would just fix me with this steady stare and he'd say, no, you have to believe. To do this, you have to believe you can do it, and I believe you guys can do it. Mm. And just sort of, you know, some of his words were really ringing in my ears. And it was funny, like, living in Southern society, I guess, and even in the city of Calgary, where a lot of our friends and family continue to live, a very urban environment, the doubts were greater in those kinds of places. But once we got farther and farther north, and closer to the people who actually knew this caribou herd and their movements and knew that environment, certainly there were still doubts, but those doubts seemed to be less the farther north and the closer we got to the actual start of the journey. So by the time we set off, I think the doubts were starting to almost fade a little bit. And just like, yeah, like maybe this is possible. And so off we went. I mean, we were still doubtful, we were still worried, but off we went. There comes a time, I think, in any trip, and maybe it's just a moment, where you just have to kind of throw yourself at the fate and the compassion of the world with the belief that it will accept, maybe even nurture, embrace you know, the world, that there is compassion just in the greater world to see you through a difficult time. And that might come in swimming a river, it might come in a bear encounter. It's sort of in these moments of lack of control. And normally those moments take many days, if not weeks, or maybe even months to get to on a normal scheduled journey where you have your route set out before you. I think with this journey, we had to confront that moment right at the start. We had to say, we are sort of going to step off and out into the great unknown and a great unknown idea and a great unknown landscape. But we believe that the world is this compassionate place that will sort of greet that courage and reward that bravery with incredible experience. And I think this was a trip which demanded that very early on, that kind of commitment. And it was difficult to do, but it also came with incredible rewards. And I think those are the rewards that excited me the most about telling this journey in the book, and something that we could get at a lot more in printed word than we could in the film, is sort of the spiritual side of this trip, what happened as we let go of our human tendencies to be fixated on goals and objectives and became much more open to happenstance and unscheduled encounters and directions taking hold of us and steering us to different places, not only in the physical landscape, but the mental landscape as well.
One of the things that amazes me about your journey is, first of all, you had an idea of approximately how far it would be to the calving grounds. How far was that?
Well, a straight line distance, I guess, or arcing along one of the mountain ranges which the caribou might take on their migration would be somewhere in the order of 400 miles to the calving ground. And the caribou movements, once they do start the migration, once they select a route, it tends to be fairly direct migrating to the calving ground. After the calving happens, and the post-calving movements, because we needed, you know, to have a true measure of what the value of the calving grounds are to this caribou herd, we felt we not only had to get there with the caribou herd, but the value of those calving grounds was also in everything they went through to get back to their winter grain.
That is what actually, I think, is, it takes us to a whole other level. I think a lot of people can imagine following a caribou herd to their calving grounds and saying, wow, we did that. You committed to a return trip. That to me is, I mean, it's almost incomprehensible for me to say, having gone through what you did, 400 miles in this kind of condition, I think I would have said, that's enough. Okay, you know. But you had another whole other, and we'll talk about that, but you had also to commit to returning through the same, hitting this again. You guys went a long ways.
Yeah, it was about, in its entirety, I mean, you do tons of, especially after the calving, when their movements become much more random, kind of circling, feeding, and at the whim of insects and winds, there's a lot more meandering, and so it's impossible to know exactly what distance we traveled, but kind of roughing it out on maps, it was somewhere in the order of 1,000 miles, the whole trip over the span of 5 months.
Mm-hmm.
And really to kind of, articulate it very plainly for the listener, you know, this is truly one of the largest, wildest intact ecosystems and landscapes, wild landscapes left in the entire world. I mean, we wandered through this area for 5 months. The range of the caribou herd is somewhere in the order of about 90,000 square miles. And in those 5 months, you know, we didn't cross one road, we didn't cross one pipeline. There aren't any power lines there, except for the villages of Old Crow and over on the Alaskan side, places like Veneti and Antarctic Village, which are all below tree line. There's no human habitation. There's, you know, apart from the odd research shack, there's no human structure. So we're really talking about a vast, vast, wild, open area and one of the wildest areas left.
You left in April. And talk about a lot of people think, well, April, that's spring, but let's talk now about your taking off and how you tried to find and determine where these caribou were. I mean, that all by itself is, I mean, you're walking and you're carrying all of this stuff, and then you're supposed to somehow figure out where they are and catch up to them. Let's discuss that journey. Until the moment where you actually, because there's many, many levels to this, and your book goes into this, and it's an extraordinary story. But let's try to get to the, let's move from this point now to where you finally made contact.
Okay, and just to, again, place the listener a little bit. So we left in early April, and this was in 2003. And early April, and we're just north of the Arctic Circle, so you're already getting a lot of light well past the normal evening and night hours that you'd be used to in more southern locales. So it was light from about 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. at
wow.
this time.
Hmm.
And those days are only going to lengthen as the trip goes on. Of course, start to decrease after the summer solstice. But the temperatures during those nights are still getting down to somewhere in the order of minus 35 degrees Fahrenheit. So frigid. And then if it was sunny during the day, they would climb, you know, very close to freezing.
Hmm.
So you're going everything from traveling in a light jacket and a light wool hat to being burrowed underneath this a down sleeping bag that is, you know, almost a foot thick, with feathers at night, just curled up against one another for warmth. So that gives you an idea of the temperatures. And the landscape is quite rolling, so quite high hills that then start to break out into rocky ridges the farther north you go. And lightly treed, again, and soft snow where the trees are, so kind of wallowing along these caribou trenches. And whether animals were traveling, they would, you know, in the interest of saving energy, they would have been traveling single file. So these trenches you're following have literally been passed over by tens of thousands of hoofs, so they're very well packed. And so they're, you know, apart from their uneven surface, they're almost like these very, very narrow sidewalks. But we were tied to those. We couldn't move anywhere else out into the landscape. And then what started happening as we followed them over the first few days, the caribou, where they had fanned out to feed, all of a sudden those thousands of hooves are splitting and forking until you're on, and you have to make a decision each time which one to follow. And so we're always following the most well-packed trail, but after some time, if the entire herd had fanned out to feed on the lichens poking through on the rocks or some of the lower tree branches on a hillside, all of a sudden you're in soft snow again because only one animal has gone anywhere. They're not walking single file anymore. They're just feeding. Mm. And you'd have to find the place where all those single trails collected and braided back together into a rope of a trail where you could follow it back out. So incredibly kind of confusing, and even these patterns we hadn't really thought about ahead of time. We just assumed, okay, once we're on a trail, we're on a trail. But a trail changes as time goes on. So we really struggled for that first little bit, and we noticed over the first few days the tracks that we're following are getting older. And so we haven't even found the caribou, or we haven't seen caribou yet. And of course, in the back of our minds, is this even possible? And we're getting direct feedback that maybe it is, but we're already falling behind. We're not traveling as fast as animals. We're falling. But then, you know, things are very dynamic, of course, and things started to change as we got a little bit higher on the ridge tops. The snow would be harder because it'd be windswept, and we could travel faster and even ski at times. So we started making up some time there. The trees started to thin out the farther north we went. And the weather during the day, especially, started to warm to the extent that some of the south-facing slopes actually started to lose some of their snow. The sun would carry enough heat during the day that it would uncover some of the grass and lichens and caribou forage underneath. And this was incredibly well-timed on the caribou's part. I mean, they would have known that this was happening. And all of a sudden, the investment of starting to head north from the soft snow into that a tundra landscape where it's concrete snow in the winter, it would pay off because the sun would be starting to melt that concrete like snow, and they could continue to feed as they headed north. Well, what that did is it started to slow them down. And so by the end of the first week, Leanne and I were starting to encounter some small groups of caribou. And again, we weren't convinced of whether they were feeding or migrating still. And finally, I think it was on day five, as we climbed probably one of our first really, really tough ascents of one of the bigger mountains, and kind of sitting exhausted on the top, sweating, all of a sudden groups of thousands of caribou started to thunder from behind us and come up this incredibly steep slope in our wake and move around us through that first night.
And what was your feeling at that time?
That was sort of euphoria. I mean, everything we had ever imagined this trip could be, and you know, this is a trip a year in the preparation, and all the sort of visuals we'd had in our mind of what it could ever be, and sounds, you know, the snorts and the click of tendons as they're passing around the tent, the smell of the urine and the tufts of hair blowing past us in the breeze, everything that we'd ever imagined. All of a sudden, it was happening right there around us on day five, and it was unbelievable. And not only that, but, you know, from that same ridge, we watched our first wolf chase of the caribou take place, and to watch that from this ridge and this horde of animals kind of move almost like a school of fish with this dot steering and moving and breaking them apart behind them, just to see those kind of patterns on that vast scale. scale in this beautiful open landscape, we were just completely blown away. So all of a sudden, there was no doubts in our mind, and even though we'd been exhausted minutes before, all of a sudden we were just filled with this surge of energy. And I think that was very much the beginning of this sort of tension that goes on throughout the entire trip, where we're trying to keep that feeling. Like we've almost already become addicted to that feeling of being in amongst the caribou, of that power, of that energy, of that life, of things happening all the time, and that becomes our motivation for moving and for pushing ourselves further and further, physically and mentally, during the course of the many months that transpired.
That had to have been a massively spiritual moment, where suddenly the purpose of this becomes real.
I think, you know, it certainly was spiritual, but it was almost, I think the real sort of spiritual, it was too early for the real sort of spiritual things to start happening. Mm-hmm. We still were very much sort of modern technical humans,
gotcha,
carrying the baggage of all the ways we've been indoctrinated to think and perceive the world with us. And so, I mean, even, you know, it's evident in my journal entries that first night, like I'm really trying to describe the actual numbers of the caribou that we're seeing. And I'm not really going into a lot of detail about my own feelings or what the caribou are evoking. I mean, I'm just sort of describing the physical scene.
You're being the field biologist.
Yeah, you know, very, very analytical and descriptive and almost objective. You know, I'm just sort of trying to describe it almost as an observer, a distant observer, rather than as a participant.
I'm just curious, at that point you finally made contact, you were able to experience how fast these animals are traveling. Did that surprise? I mean, as you watched them literally move, did you have wonders if you could actually maintain? How fast did they move, and did you feel you could keep up?
Yeah, I mean, up to this point, before we'd seen them, the question that had been brewing in our minds are they migrating yet or not? To see these thousands of animals rushing and literally turning like the snow, these snowy trails became black, I mean, sort of pounded down to the bare earth. And so you're seeing these threads of brown dirt across this vast white landscape, and the speed by which they're moving, running, you know, at times, galloping. You're all of a sudden the question switches to, oh my gosh, certainly they're migrating, but can we keep up? And I think the thing that we wanted to just keep going, like to pack up right there and keep going, even though we've been going 11 hours that day and just completed this incredibly difficult climb to this ridgetop. And I think, you know, right there, like Leanne is sort of much more pragmatic and reasonable, I think, when it comes to thinking about the long haul. And she really was sort of this moderating force in our very small team on the expedition of I would constantly almost be obsessed with like taking off and literally trying to do everything the caribou were doing straight away, like, okay, they're moving through the night, let's move through the night. But Leanne was much more cautious in those beginning stages, and I think that very rightly so, you know, she was thinking a lot about pacing herself so that we could continue to travel for months on end.
That by itself becomes its own challenge.
Yeah, and very much tension, you know, like, so you're all constantly gambling, if we sleep now and the caribou are continuing to move, are we going to lose them forever? And that was a tension that played out through the whole trip, and as you remember from the book, I mean, there were significant periods of time where we had lost them and were kind of kicking ourselves for earlier decisions we'd made, and there are also points where there's a tension between Leanne and I, and she's saying, you know, let's stop, let's rest, let's hold ourselves back, and I'm pushing in it at one point in the trip post-calving. You know, I really had to push hard, and it was important for us to just give up absolutely everything in terms of sleep, eating, and any semblance of being human and comfortable in order to keep up with the post-calving rush.
very, very powerful moment in the book. How long did it take from that point then to reach the calving areas in Anwar?
Well, we first encountered the caribou at the end of the first week, and it was another 5 weeks before we would reach the calving ground. So in total of 1.5 months on the spring migration.
And that is a story that is filled with every conceivable level of challenge, joy, frustration, etc. Plus, ran into some really difficult moments, literally where your life was on the line. It came at many different times. I'm just curious if you could give us some examples of some of the moments where you really wondered how things were going to turn out.
Yeah, I think a few really stand out on spring migration. I think our first serious Arctic blizzard was a real testing time for both Dan and I. I mean, neither of us, even in our high-altitude climbing, had never experienced anything like this, where the wind is literally bending the poles of the tent flat, and you're inside braced against it with crystals of snow driven through, you know, the microscopic pores of the fabric of the tent, so that it's snowing inside this tent as well as outside. And just howling, and the whole tent is kind of collapsing, and then popping up again and collapsing again. It's like you're inside this Gore-Tex hyperventilating lung. And we're terrified. You know, there's no shelter anywhere. This is our life around us of fabric and stitches. And we're expecting every seam with every gust and every stitch, just praying that you know, the they're not going to rip and fray. And it very much felt like it was going to. And almost panicked, I think, in that first Arctic storm.
And how long were you in that state?
Probably for about close to 24 hours that first time.
Temperatures?
Temperatures weren't terrible. I think the air temperature would have been somewhere around minus 10.
Yeah, that's cold, though. When you're human, 10 below zero with wind is terrible.
Yeah, I mean, the wind would have been somewhere in the order of, you know, between 100 and 150 miles an hour.
Oh, my God.
Just unbelievable. You couldn't stand. And then, you know, finally, in this first blizzard, what I did was, or what I decided, just like, this tent is going to rip to shreds around us by this wind. And so I went outside and I managed to sort of carve out these snow blocks from the rock hard drifts with our, we had one aluminum snow shovel between us, and create this sort of V-shaped windbreak built out of this rock-like snow upwind of us. And as I was doing that, I looked up at one point, and through the sort of horizontal haze of driving snow and cloud, I see these shapes, and they're moving, and some are lying down, and some are even like grazing on these tufts of grass that are being pushed flat against the snow by the wind. And I just couldn't believe my eyes, and I dove back into the tent, and suddenly, and there's caribou outside. And she was just, you know, she didn't believe me. And she looks up, like, sure enough, these caribou, you know, in that moment sort of became our guides towards how, that this was sort of, this was an everyday occurrence, almost. Like, it wasn't abnormal. And the caribou would survive, and we would survive. And somehow, you know, the storm didn't become any less intense in that moment, but somehow our worry really subsided. And guided by these caribou, or supported almost by these caribou that had surrounded us, that we were going through this together and we would all survive. And then probably the next thing that really challenged us the most was when the grizzly bears started to come out of their dens, started to come out of hibernation in early May. And the landscape is still quite snowy at this point and still very frozen. And we're skiing across it, and you can see, you know, for tens of miles at times from the ridgetops, no trees hiding anything. And you would see four or five grizzly bears at a time wandering across this landscape, these dark sort of silhouette cutout shapes across the white vastness. And as it turned out, all of them were doing exactly what we were doing, following this caribou herd, except they were doing it, you know, not to get to the calving grounds per se, but in the hopes of some lucking into some post-hibernation meal. And Leanne joked to me, you know, it's not long before one of these bears is going to realize we're the slowest caribou going. I kind of laughed too. We were concerned, but figured that we would be foreign enough that none of these bears would really want to mess with us. But that very afternoon, one was incredibly curious and approached where we were setting up camp. And then we managed to finally sort of shoo it off with shouts and waving our ski poles. But that night after moving camp, because of that initial curious bear, you know, I think probably one of the moments in the entire trip where we really did consider giving it all up and what we were doing was ridiculous was when this particularly old, hungry, quite small, but very thin and sickly-looking female, a desperate bear, essentially, on the edge of starvation, came in, circled us, and began, essentially it stalked us for 1.5 miles and wouldn't leave us alone where we were setting up camp for the second time. And that story and that encounter and how we finally resolved it, I think really is sort of one of the emotional, high point is the wrong way to describe it, but
yeah,
the most emotionally charged point, you know, both in the trip and in the book, and lots of questions answered back and forth between Leanne and I on really how reasonable it is for us to continue, given that we in fact have been treated as prey by one of these many animals now that are roaming along the caribou trail with us.
Yeah, you don't want this to become the story of survival with a bear tracking you and waiting for its most, you know, that we've heard those stories before.
Yeah, I guess ultimately, you know, what we decided in all our options of aborting the trip or not, in a way, I don't think we really did decide consciously. Because it's such a vast landscape, it's so remote, and it's so difficult to land a plane in, even a bush plane at that time of year on skis, we would have had to travel for at least 2 days to even get to a place along the coast of the Arctic Ocean where a plane could have landed. And more likely than not, we would have waited a number of days more for good weather until that plane could land. And so we didn't have any immediate escape. You know, we couldn't head back to the ski lodge or hop in the car and drive home. Regardless of whether we just had to continue the trip or not, we would still have to survive those next 4 or 5 days in amongst the grizzly bears. And so we decided, well, let's just keep going today and see what happens. And I think, just the act of moving and the rhythm of moving itself, and certainly, you know, anybody who's done a long trip has felt this. I mean, it's sort of like all your worries and concerns, they don't disappear, but I think the act of moving, because that's what we've evolved to do, and that's what we've done for, you know, the greater part of the 1.5 million years of human evolution, I think it really kind of puts all the stresses and concerns into their rightful place. And for us, that did happen. So after a while, I think we came to terms with, the notion that to truly be caribou, to experience what they did, experience on the incredible journey that they do every year, we had to come to terms with the possibility of dying. And certainly I think we talked about that before leaving on the trip, but now we're really confronted with it in sort of a living, furry, well-clawed, toothed animal that had really come in and challenged our sense of mortality. And I think at that point in the trip, we did really accept that we could die on this journey. And that was a really important step to take to get to, I think, the sort of mental state of being caribou.
One of the aspects as well, then, is the fact that you would have to have your resupplies airdropped in, and you had a choice at that point. You could say enough. You know, at certain points you were running out of food, you're running low on food, and you'd have to make decisions to bring in the food. Give us a sense of how that would happen.
Well, normally, you know, when we had, say, 2 or 3 days of food left in our packs, we would start to say, okay, well, given our current trajectory and everything, where would be a reasonable place to receive a food drop? And if it's going to be dropped in the air, you want us to find an open place and hopefully with some soft snow, not too many rocks, so that the things that are being thrown on the plane, and, you know, the plane would be traveling at an airspeed of somewhere around 60 miles an hour. So, and dropping from a few hundred feet up, you're really quite worried about, you know, all these bags of rice and stuff breaking open on the tundra.
Yeah.
And so that's one consideration. Another thing, you know, we were recording this journey as well, through still photographs and through film. And so at any opportunity, we wanted to send that film out so that it wouldn't be lost or damaged. And also, it would just add up to a fair bit of weight over time. And so any opportunity to actually land a plane, whether it was on a frozen lake in winter or an open lake in summer, we would try to capitalize on those opportunities. So, you know, we were trying to stay with caribou, and yet we found ourselves every couple of weeks kind of pulled back to our dependencies as modern humans in having support from the outside world. And it was an interesting dynamic that started to happen as the journey unfolded, is that we would have these incredible moments and even prolonged moments in terms of weeks of traveling and being in amongst the herd. And then we would decide, okay, we need food, we're going to try to receive it at this lake. And almost every single time, we would make that decision, commit to it, make the phone call to the pilot, give him our location, and then the weather would close in, and we would spend 3, 4, at one point even 6 days waiting. And meanwhile, the caribou have moved on. We're losing them. And so it was this tension between sort of our dependence on the outside world undermining our ability to really be a part of this caribou migration, and then sort of trying to, once we did receive the food drop, at one point anyway, near the end of the trip, you know, on the pretty much starving and having to trap ground squirrels and things to survive as we're waiting for it, then trying to sort of regain our place in amongst the migration, and that sort of became this back and forth dynamic that played out during the entire journey.
I'm just curious, from a sort of a technical perspective here, if you had to relay your location, would you rely on GPS and map, I suppose, is how you were kind of tracking through your journey?
Yes. Yeah, it was a combination of things. Yeah, so we carried a small GPS receiver, and at times that actually came in handy. Like, I've never used one or had felt the need to use one before, but when you get into some of the open tundra landscapes where the features are very uniform and indistinct, and then you layer, you know, coastal fog or blizzard conditions on top of that, To travel and navigate through that to some of these set locations for receiving food drops, or to try to return to your last point where you've been amongst caribou, you know, those tools definitely helped. And that, you know, sort of a side note on the modern tools, this trip probably wouldn't have been possible to do in the style that we did it, say, 5 years ago even. Satellite phones were these big, heavy briefcase objects until, you know, just a few years ago. Now they're the size of a portable cordless phone that you have in your house. And even the recharging technology, you know, to a small, flexible, very robust solar panel, nickel metal hydride batteries instead of nickel cadmium, are much lighter. Just all these little details of technology that really enabled us to do this trip, just two people, no film crew, carrying everything that we would need to not only do the trip but film it on our backs. I don't think that opportunity or technical opportunity existed until, you know, a very short time ago. And yet, in terms of following caribou, allowing ourselves to be steered by their movements and migrations is a very old human activity. I mean, that is one of the really neat things about the trip, is when we did return to Old Crow, the Gwich'in native village, at the end of the trip, the way we talked and the stories we told had elders weeping because of how much it reminded them of the very language and sort of visual images that, that their parents and grandparents' stories had evoked of when they had followed the caribou, not necessarily to get to their calving ground, but simply to eat and survive.
You became indigenous. At what point?
But still, you know, this is kind of the ironic thing, still heavily dependent on modern technology to do that.
Good point. Good point. It sounds as if somewhere in this realm you were becoming caribou. That is to say that your spirit and your purpose and your will became truly locked in with that migrating herd. Was there a moment where you began to sense the first sense of being caribou?
A couple of things, I guess, to answer that question. And to me, incidentally, and you know, I just let the listener know that, you know, I'm trained as a scientist to see the world rationally, discrete parcels, and sort of have an analytically trained mind. But the transformation that I felt happened during this journey, I think, and the spiritual transformation is probably one of the most exciting parts of the trip. And I guess, you know, on any long journey, what happens is that the layers of your old self, and sort of your, I guess, almost your fabricated self, start to fall away like layers of an onion. And this started to happen to Leanne and I, and we all know kind of the, sometimes you're hiking along or skiing along, and this old song might pop into your mind, for instance. And the lyrics just won't leave, you know, like they rattle around in your head, and they rattle around in your head. Sometimes it takes days. And this started to happen to Leanne and I after a couple of weeks, after we sort of start to settle into the rhythm of falling caribou and give way to this whole notion of surrendering to all their movements and let the caribou guide us rather than our preconceptions guide us. Of having destinations and goals. But as our mind sort of started to relax and open up to that, these old song lyrics, these old phone numbers, all this sort of mental clutter, like these useless facts and figures that we all, and jingles that we carry around in our heads, all those began to fall away. And in the lack, you know, in the absence of billboards, and advertisements, and radios blaring, and, you know, checking email and all the things that we kind of are distracted by in modern society, in the absence of those sort of filling that void or filling that space that was created as we were shedding all these other memories, I think we really began to unearth and uncover sort of our elemental self. And a lot of that elemental self, I think, is in the acuity of the senses. So we felt our senses becoming much sharper in terms of vision, smell, hearing. And as the trip went on, also just sort of almost like a sixth sense of knowing. And the sixth sense, I think, is I describe it as something as thrumming in the book. And thrumming is the sound that the caribou would make when they were together in large groups. But it isn't really a sound. It's more like a rumbling or a vibration. I think in the reading I've done since on whale song and other modes of animal communication, a lot of it is sort of infrasonic on the lower end or beyond the lower end of human hearing. And yet as Leanne and I sort of became sort of much more pure and much less distracted and much more focused, this sound that I had initially heard a little bit or felt sort of rumbling in the chest, and it's not, I'm not talking about the drumming of hooves on the tundra here, I'm talking about something else, almost like a humming, an energetic hum that comes up through your feet. I'd felt it a few times on the spring migration, but it wasn't until after the calving ground that we started to follow the caribou in their post-calving wanderings that we really started to tap into it, not just as, and it started to supersede, actually, and replace conventional methods of tracking the caribou, where, you know, we wouldn't look so much at ground signs in terms of hoof prints and fecal pellets that had been left behind on where we would find caribou next. down, we would wake up from a nap, and this humming, we would sort of cock our heads and look at each other and, you know, try to articulate, yeah, it's coming from somewhere over there. And we would point sort of obliquely to some ridge, and we would pack up and let's just start heading in that direction. And a few hours later, we'd top over that ridge, and sure enough, there's a large group of caribou that had been around us when we'd fallen asleep, and that's where they'd moved to. So this, you know, we uncovered in our attempt to become caribou, I think, or in our attempt to, you know, to be caribou, we uncovered, I think, through the elemental sense of what it is to be human. Like we were able to tap into some of our biological potential, our wild potential, our instinctual potential that has become inundated, covered, and forgotten, I think, in the modern world. And that really became exciting to me, you know, to be steered by senses and knowledge in a realm and dimension that I'd never accessed before. And as we went along in the trip, and we became more sleep deprived and more hungry and starved and thirsty and muddled up by what was day and night as we're trying to follow caribou through you know, all periods of daytime and nighttime. We started to have, and you're literally feeling almost kind of dizzy at times from this state of exhaustion. And it was all, I guess, I kind of likened it almost to like a shaman sort of trying to will themselves or work themselves through dance and fasting and song into a whole other realm of consciousness. Well, we didn't consciously try to do that, but the caribou had kind of sent us on that journey that became that dance. And much like a shaman sort of transcends into a different level of consciousness and accesses a dream world, which can inform them of events in the future, that started to happen to us as well, where our dreams, you know, really started to articulate scenes and dramas that would unfold hours later. And so the thrumming, our dreams, and these visions started to become the mode by which we would make decisions and inform our movements as we became closer and closer to tapping to the very energy that sends this great herd coursing across the tundra for thousands of miles every year.
Being Caribou with Karsten Hoyer continues after a short break.